If you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
CIOU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Signal Resources Limited, Thunder Bay's locally owned and operated audio-visual professionals. Contact them about your next multimedia event or installation at 807-475-9341 or at signalresources.com. The Thunder Bay Community Auditorium. Find them at tbca.com to purchase tickets and find out all of the details on their upcoming events. Vox Popular Media Arts Festival, located inside Trinity Hall at 310 Park Avenue. Join the fun every September for the annual Media Arts Fest, entering its 16th year in 2020.
CILU now presents World in Progress.
DW, World in Progress. With Sarah Steffen.
Welcome to the show. I'm Sarah Steffen. The first coronavirus vaccines are being rolled out now. Is this a proverbial light at the end of the tunnel? Some experts say not so fast.
Vaccines do not equal zero COVID. Vaccines and vaccination will add a major, major, powerful tool to the toolkit that we have. But by themselves, they will not do the job.
Not all people will receive the vaccine right away. It will certainly take time to produce enough doses for everyone.
We need to vaccinate more than 7 billion people. And if the first couple of vaccines are any indication, these are multi-dose vaccines. Developing countries will need both equitable access to the vaccines, but also support in having the systems in place to actually deliver the vaccine and to vaccinate their populations.
We also hear how musicians have been faring in a year that was dominated by lockdowns and other restrictions. These stories and more now on DW's World in Progress. And we start the show in India. The South Asian country has the world's second highest total of COVID-19 infections, after the US. At the time of this recording, India had over 9.9 million documented coronavirus cases and over 144,000 deaths. That's according to data provided by the Johns Hopkins University. With a population of around 1.4 billion people, India could soon become the stage for one of the largest vaccination campaigns worldwide. But it's no easy feat, as both the country's size and climate pose huge challenges. Bernd Muschborowska has more. His report is presented by Natalie Muller.
In the race to secure the largest market for a coronavirus vaccine, two companies are now one step ahead. On the heels of the US pharmaceutical company Pfizer, which has developed a vaccine together with German company BioNTech, the Serum Institute has now also applied for emergency approval of its vaccine in India. With a population of around 1.4 billion people, India could soon become the stage for one of the largest vaccination campaigns worldwide. A vaccine will be necessary if the country hopes to immunize its population against COVID-19. By the middle of next year, the government plans to vaccinate up to 300 million people. But it's no easy task. India's size and climate both pose huge challenges. The so-called Oxford vaccine, which is being developed at the Serum Institute together with pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca, must be stored and transported at temperatures between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius. The vaccine from Pfizer and BioNTech requires the cold chain to be maintained at minus 70 degrees. Numerous experts have expressed serious concerns over whether this logistical task can be managed. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi recently called on state governments to start prepping cold storage facilities so the vaccination program can begin as soon as possible.
We need to determine the need for cold storage rooms for the vaccine. States should build the necessary storage capacities. This needs to be taken into account as well as where they should be located in and which size.
But experts are warning that not every vaccine developed may be suited to the general conditions in India. The price of the vaccine is also an issue. Suresh Jadhav, the director of the Serum Institute in Pune, explains.
One has to be very careful in choosing a product, what is good for their demography, what facilities that they already have in place, how much they can store, and how they can distribute. It will all depend upon, I think, the preparedness of the individual countries and the individual government that which product they will go. And of course, for the developing world and for the procurement by the Gavi or by other UN agencies like UNICEF or PAHO, most of the countries would like to have a product which is affordable.
How much the vaccine will cost in India hasn't been decided yet. While US company Pfizer adjusts the price based on the number of ordered doses, the Serum Institute has recommended a price of around 1,000 rupees, roughly 12 euros, for two doses. Although the number of new infections is slowly falling, all hope rests on the swift approval of a vaccine. But the World Health Organization is warning against getting hopes up too high. At a conference in Geneva, the director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Mike Ryan, said COVID-19 won't simply disappear once vaccine programs are rolled out.
Vaccines do not equal zero COVID. Vaccines and vaccination will add a major, major, powerful tool to the toolkit that we have. But by themselves, they will not do the job. And therefore, we have to add vaccines into an existing public health strategy. We will have to continue to work on managing our personal behavior, our hygiene. And in many cases, we need to recognize that the vaccine will not be with everyone early next year.
Meanwhile, the case of a 67-year-old politician taking part in a clinical test for a vaccine is making headlines in India. The cabinet minister for the state of Haryana was one of the first in his state to volunteer for the anti-COVID vaccine. Just days later, he tested positive for the virus.
Natalie Muller with that report by Bernd Mushborowska. The first coronavirus vaccines are being rolled out. It's something that's been highly anticipated. Developing these vaccines has been described as a race. Scientists around the world had been working round the clock to find vaccines that could stop the spread of COVID-19. Now, however, there are fears that there might be a race between countries to secure enough doses for their population. In particular, that developing countries could be losing out. Earlier, I spoke with Mandeep Dhaliwal, director of the United Nations Development Programme's HIV Health and Development Group. I started by asking her how we can ensure developing nations get their hands on enough coronavirus vaccines.
This is going to be a vaccination program of historic proportion. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in our lifetime. We need to vaccinate more than 7 billion people. And if the first couple of vaccines are any indication, these are multi-dose vaccines. Developing countries will need both equitable access to the vaccines, but also support in having the systems in place to actually deliver the vaccine and to vaccinate their populations. Developing countries and developed countries alike have a big challenge in mounting a vaccination program of this size. And I think we know from the HIV experience that not every country will get access, timely, equitable access. So WHO had set up the Access to COVID-19 tools, the ACT Accelerator, which is a time-limited global collaboration to accelerate the development, production, and access to these new COVID health technologies, including the vaccine. There's a pillar on vaccines that's led by CEPI, the Global Alliance for Vaccines, and WHO, which is called COVAX. I'm sure people are starting to hear that term being used. But the focus of COVAX is very much on ensuring, you know, that developing countries also have equitable access to vaccines. So COVAX is, and the ACT Accelerator, I mean, has been largely focused, rightly so, on the development of vaccines now. But I think now we have to very quickly pivot and turn our attention to delivering these vaccines through large-scale vaccination programs.
You've already said it's a massive undertaking. It's 7 billion people, and it's multi-dose, so that means more than one shot. How long will it take until each and every person on the planet got their shot against coronavirus?
That's a multi-million dollar question right there. And my prediction is that it's going to take us well into 2021, 2022. Large-scale adult vaccination programs are not easy to mount. We need to do two things at the same time, which is strengthen the systems for the vaccination programs, but at the same time also maintain the public health messaging. First of all, take the vaccine. It's safe and it's effective. Secondly, we need to get to 75 to 80% coverage of vaccination. In the meantime, you still need to wear a mask, you still need to physically distance, and you still need to wash your hands. But I'm hoping for a snowball effect. We also have to contend with the issue of misinformation and disinformation. We're already starting to see a lot of sort of strange information being put out there about vaccines. So one of the latest rumors I heard on social media, or that I read on social media, was that the mRNA vaccine, which is the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine, as well as the Moderna vaccine, that they can alter your DNA, which is completely false. But, you know, there's a lot of this misinformation and vaccine hesitancy that we're also going to have to combat as part of the public health information. So I think it's going to take at least a year, if not more, to vaccinate 75 to 80% of the world's population to achieve the optimum effect from some of these first vaccines that are coming out. But it's a big challenge, but I am very inspired by the fact that we went from discovery of a new virus to an actual set of vaccine candidates, several vaccine candidates, which are so effective, like above 90% effectiveness, that we can also, if we work together, global solutions for global problems, that we could actually deliver this vaccine to everyone who needs it in a year.
To those people who are skeptical when it comes to the coronavirus vaccine or vaccines in general, what do you say to them?
I think it's probably one of the most powerful public health interventions in the world, vaccination. And if you look at the science, you look at the evidence on, you know, on so many of these childhood vaccination programs, you see that. So I urge people to look at credible sources and use that information rather than, and I understand people's apprehension. I can understand being nervous, but I think, you know, looking at the science and following the science is the way to go.
For developing countries, it's not just access to vaccines, but also logistics, say cargo price hikes, and how to properly store the vaccines to keep them cold enough. How can these challenges be tackled?
Well, I think this is really a multilateral effort. You know, I think everybody has a part to play, and we're starting in a tough place because we've had, in the 11 months that the vaccines have been under development, at the same time, coronavirus has been really putting an incredible strain on health systems and supply chains and logistics. So we're not starting from a fantastic place in that regard. I do think that, you know, working together, it is possible to surmount these challenges. I mean, if you just look, the vaccine for Ebola that was rolled out in the DRC was an ultra cold chain vaccine. And yet there were innovations, there was collaboration, and there was, you know, joint work to be able to successfully deliver the Ebola vaccine in some of the most challenging operating environments in the world. The other thing which gives me hope is we didn't wait until the vaccine received, you know, emergency use approval or achieved a regulatory approval to start thinking about the delivery challenges.
What would you say are the biggest challenges, in particular in Africa and Asia, when it comes to distributing a vaccine?
I think the biggest challenges are going to be around the systems, right? It's going to be around the cold chain. It's going to be around the generating demand for the vaccine and delivering in contexts where, you know, where the health systems are already incredibly strained. At the same time, in Asia and in many African countries, you know, we have extraordinary platforms from large-scale HIV programs. We have incredible community engagement, certainly from the HIV response, which can be leveraged. So I think there are resources there, but the big challenge is going to be the systems challenge there, I believe. But I think the equitable access challenge is also huge. You know, the cost of a vaccine per person, you know, if you're talking a price of $1, $2 per person, that is more than the health budget of some countries. So there needs to be some thought given to how this is all going to be financed. At the same time, if we don't distribute these COVID vaccines in a manner that is equitable, the damage is going to be phenomenal. It could cost the world up to $1.2 trillion, which we can't afford given the impact that we've already seen on economies and the contraction of GDPs in so many countries.
And let alone the amount of deaths that we've seen as well.
Exactly, exactly. So I think the big lesson from COVID is to solve the economic problem, you need to solve the public health problem or the health problem first. So it's not one versus the other, but actually by addressing the health issue, you can actually address the economic issue as well. There's no better way to prove that than by ensuring equitable access to the COVID vaccine.
You're listening to World in Progress on CILU 102.7 FM.
Now, Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa, has said it will give priority to those who are considered most vulnerable. How can countries make sure the most vulnerable are actually being served first rather than those with the deepest pockets?
Well, I think this is the thing. There needs to be a prioritization that is done with support in terms of really kind of working out who is the most vulnerable. So, for example, we're already hearing in countries that, you know, we're going to vaccinate the elderly, healthcare workers, essential workers. So there's already guidance, I think, that's coming from the World Health Organization and the multilateral system on how to prioritize to ensure equitable access. And it's very good to hear that countries are already talking about first vaccinating the most vulnerable people.
Thanks to Mandeep Dhaliwal, director of the United Nations Development Programme's HIV Health and Development Group. The novel coronavirus has claimed over 1.6 million lives, and more than 73 million cases have been registered so far. These are figures from the Johns Hopkins University at the time of this recording. The coronavirus was first documented in the Chinese city of Wuhan about a year ago. In China, workers have returned to factories and offices, students are back in the classroom, and people are even hitting the dance floor in Shanghai, as Steffen Wurzel reports. Neil King has the story.
In Shanghai, people are hitting the dance floor, just like before the COVID-19 pandemic. Across China's big cities, people are going out again. Statistically speaking, the risk of infection is very low in the world's most populous country, with the number of new infections per day down to single digits. And most of those cases are reportedly brought back to China by travelers returning from abroad. For the most part, life has gotten back to normal, though it's still common for people to have their temperatures measured before entering government offices, banks, hospitals, and some restaurants. Almost everything from stores to local gyms has reopened, not to mention schools and universities. My life has felt relatively normal since the end of March, beginning of April, says this 39-year-old from Shanghai. He says he only puts on his mask if there are a lot of people around. A local beautician artist describes what it's like in more crowded spaces.
You definitely have to wear a mask if you're going to take the subway because the air can't circulate that much. We still have to have our temperatures taken or show a health code on our phone when we go into the clubs and karaoke bars. I think it's okay. I've gotten used to it.
The health code she's referring to is generated through an app, and it's been ubiquitous since the start of the COVID crisis. The app calculates the personal risk of infection based on the person's location and data from the wireless network, and then it issues a colour, red, yellow or green. Without the app and the green light, it's nearly impossible to move through China these days. Chinese authorities can track where and when people were, even better than before, especially at train stations, airports or at toll stations on the highway. There isn't a standard app in China. Quite the opposite, in fact. Here, it's more like a digital patchwork of information. Every provincial and municipal government is muddling through. There doesn't appear to be much mutual trust among China's government agencies. At the moment when reports of new infections come out, they create a stir. This was the case when two new infections were reported in the city of Manzhouli in China's north, which became its own news story. And now, new cases usually lead to mass testing. Hundreds of thousands or even several million people are then tested within a matter of days. And cities that have been hit are isolated to a great extent from the rest of the country. Mass testing and consistent tracing are the most important tools the Chinese authorities have in the battle against the coronavirus. Personnel and money are no object. And then there are the country's external borders, which have been all but sealed off. But one of the most decisive factors has been the use of surveillance and digital profiles. And unlike in Europe, there are currently no public debates on matters like these, whether it's about surveillance, COVID measures, or even the source of the pandemic.
Neil King presenting that report by Stefan Wurzel. The coronavirus pandemic has also taken a toll on musicians. Most of their live gigs were cancelled, and it was tough to even meet up for practice. Now, bluegrass music isn't necessarily associated with Germany, yet it's found a loyal following here. Kathleen Schuster met up with a few musicians and has this story.
A young woman, face mask off for now, sings passionately as she picks away at a banjo. The floor vibrates with the low hum of her bandmate's upright bass. It's a type of energy that's been missing for many during the COVID-19 pandemic, including for the woman on banjo, Julia Zech.
Yeah, it's weird because normally you make art and you have a feedback that you get through concerts, and now you get it, sure, a little bit online, but it feels a bit like you're in this empty space working for yourself, and I miss that, having an audience.
Julia and her bandmate Pierce Black play as a duo called Stereo Naked. They're part of a very niche, very small bluegrass scene in the western city of Cologne that's currently on hold. Here in Cologne, bluegrass has stuck to its American roots. Professionals and amateurs alike meet up to jam, riffing on old tunes reminiscent of bonfires and barn raisings.
I mean, there's also a sort of social gathering around this music. I think a lot of people that I've talked to really, really miss this. And in some ways, it's been carrying on. We meet up when we can in smaller groups.
Like other musicians in the scene, Pierce and Julia make part of their living from playing gigs. Last year alone, they played over 150 concerts across Europe. This year, the majority of shows have been canceled, and many musicians have burned through their savings. Luckily, the state where Cologne is located is one that's given freelance musicians up to 16,000 euros this year so far, most all of which is meant for business expenses. So Julia and Pierce are putting it toward an album. But how creative are they feeling right now? Well, it depends on who you ask.
For me, it actually has been quite a productive time because I need a lot of time at home to write songs. And actually on our latest album that we are writing at the moment, Pierce wrote a song about how it is to sit at home and write songs, actually. So you were also productive.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, maybe a little bit, yeah. Yeah.
Quench my heart's desire.
These stipends are the only help that's been given to freelance musicians, leaving state welfare as the only other option for a steady income. But to Pierce and Julia's friend, Jon Laukamp, going on welfare felt wrong. He says he didn't lose his job. He simply can't perform in public because of coronavirus. So he decided to innovate. He took on new students via Skype and started taking local bluegrass online, like in this video. On a cold and cloudy day, when I saw that here's come rolling for to carry my mother away. Well, the circus. Jon and another musician began learning the basics of video editing and performing on camera. In this video, they had the core bluegrass group they usually play with each record his own part. Then they spliced it together and left a space for improvisation for anyone who wanted to send in a track. Jon says learning new skills has been great. The lockdown, though, has cast a different light on music for him.
At some point, I really lost touch with music. I have to say, like 2 months in or something like that, I really kind of forgot what it was all about because I didn't play with other people. But then we did a jam session, of course, with lots of distance in the park in Cologne. It was really, really cool. We got there like at 10 in the evening in the summer. And we were playing like till like 6 or 7 in the morning. It was amazing. It felt really good, I have to say. By and by, Lord, by and by,
there's a better home awaiting. He's currently working on bluegrass video tutorials, the first ever in German, with the same guy he put the jam session together with. Still, it's been an eye-opening year, not just financially, but also about how musicians live with crazy hours and so much uncertainty. Which raises the question, what will Cologne's music scene look like next year if other musicians feel the same?
It's very difficult to say because there are a few several points which will be very interesting.
That's Lukas Berg. He's a drummer and composer in Cologne and has been scrambling to organize a union that can lobby for freelance musicians whose interests have been, as he sees it, neglected. Lukas says one interesting side effect next year will probably be a plethora of new music from musicians working on albums right now. On the other hand, there's already a downside.
I already discovered or already had a lot of emails and everything about colleagues which are quitting this job and taking other jobs. Also sound technicians, engineers and everything. Really good, excellent engineers. I love to work with them. They said, you know, next year you'd ask me for a tour. I'm not sure if I'm in this still in this business. I don't think so. And that's really bad.
One major problem, according to Lukas, is that financial support for culture in Germany usually means equating culture almost exclusively with names like Bach and Beethoven.
Because Germany is really is a country, Deutschland, das Land der Dichter und Denker, you know? The country of the big, of the huge people like Beethoven and everybody's still talking about this and we here in Germany we have Beethoven and have Schiller and blah blah and all the art the old guys, you know, they would really shit them on the table if they were live right now, you know.
Meaning he thinks Germany's support of culture is all about supporting old art to the detriment of new art. And freelance musicians are a big part of producing new ideas.
All the creative people in Germany really have to think about is how can we change the position of culture? Society will be rougher, more rougher when there's less culture. I think it's pretty much what the function of culture is. It keeps the society open for new thoughts and everything, you know? And this is also with the money of the government, they're not giving the cultural sector in a way that a freelance musician can do something with it. It's just, they're not seeing the importance of really supporting freelance musicians, freelance artists. And they should. They really should. Because on the other hand, what's happening in Germany right now is that it's getting rougher. Society is getting rough. And I think culture is one element who could, you know, balance this.
Back with Stereo Naked, Pierce says, for musicians, bluegrass has become a genre about pushing boundaries. That's why it's resonated on this side of the Atlantic, and that's also exciting for their audiences.
We're such a small scene anyway. I would be very sad about the social factor if it was to die away. I think a lot of, but a lot of people will fight to keep it going, I believe.
Musicians are struggling financially, though it's unlikely they'll stop playing music completely. But when it comes time for them to perform again, will they even have an audience to play to?
I think people will always need live music. I think it won't stop at some point. But I'm concerned about the small venues than about the musicians at the moment, because we also depend on the venues. If they don't exist anymore, then we don't have anywhere to play. And yeah, just hope that they survive.
Kathleen Schuster, DW, Cologne.
And that's our show for this week. For more, go to dw.com/worldinprogress or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Celestine Masicke and Philipp Rabenstein, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.
So let's hold hands, just like we used.
CILU is supported in part by the students of Lakehead University, our sponsors, and our listeners. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Campus Tech, located in the tunnels across from LUSU at Lakehead University. They are the only Apple-authorized service provider in northwestern Ontario. They also offer educational pricing on dozens of items, as well as a wide selection of computer and gaming accessories. Stop in and chat, or check out stock and order online at campustech.ca. Magnus Theatre, bringing a revolutionary season of live theater to northwestern Ontario. Get your 2019-2020 tickets by visiting magnustheatre.com. The Argus, Lakehead University's student newspaper. Available on Wednesdays during the school year, around campus, around the city, or online at theargus.ca.
CILU now presents Living Planet.
DW, Living Planet, with Sonia Dean.
Welcome to the show. Today, it's all about insects. Those murder hornets, the threat they might pose to you and to our food. How climate change is challenging beekeepers in Botswana. And logging the genetics of traditional edible insects in South Africa. All that on this week's Living Planet. I'm Sonia Dean. Heard how a new species of hornet has invaded part of the United States. That insect is called the Asian giant hornet, also known as murder hornets. I've heard it called the least necessary subplot of 2020, what with the pandemic, crazy elections, and so on. Well, with its orange head and orange and black stripes, the Asian giant hornet is the largest hornet in the world. It's about 2 inches or 5 centimeters long and has a 3-inch wingspan. And when I started looking into this a bit more, I thought, I have got to talk to someone about it. And I found just the right person.
Hi, I'm Chris Looney. I work for the Washington State Department of Agriculture in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. And I manage our entomology lab and insect collection.
Chris Looney explained how even though not significantly more people die from the Asian giant hornet than from other insects, it did earn the nickname murder hornet due likely to the pain of its sting. As the world's largest hornet, it can inject a huge dose of venom. Chris Looney told me more.
The people up in Canada that did get stung described it as like having hot nails driven into their chest. One guy said it was like being kicked by a horse. One of the beekeepers came upon some of them still in the hive that they had killed, and they came out and stung him. And he said it took a week to recover, and he'd never been in 60 years of working with stinging insects stung by anything like it. So no joke and no fun.
Now, I read that Asian giant hornets swoop down on bees while they're flying in the air. They rip the bees' heads off, suck out their juices, and then carry the dead bodies to their nests to feed to their young. Is that about right? Because that sounds nuts to me.
More or less. What they do is they'll capture actually a whole variety of insects, not just bees. And yeah, they'll cut off the head and chew off some of the parts of the insect that aren't especially nutritive. And then they mash it up into sort of like a moist ball and they fly that back. And that's what they then feed to their babies.
Okay. It sounds so morbid, but I guess that's just nature.
Right. I mean, if you've ground up pig meat, you know, it's not horribly different.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Really? So where do these come from originally? Where are they native?
Basically Eastern Asia with scattered populations all the way across the Himalayas.
Where are they present now?
Actually, the only other place that they are present that we know of outside of their native range is our little corner of the Pacific Northwest, so British Columbia and adjacent Washington State.
How did this Asian giant hornet get to the Pacific Northwest of the United States?
The most probable answer is the same way animals and plants get moved all over the planet anyway, and that's in the massive amount of international cargo that goes back and forth across the oceans.
Global trade.
Global trade, yeah.
Were you involved in these nest findings in your region?
So this summer we had a pretty intensive trapping program. We're using just these bottle traps based on what people kind of do at home in Japan and Korea. They're basically crappy mimosas that we hung up in trees all over the place, orange juice and rice wine. We also had a really robust public reporting program where people could put things on the website or call us or email us. And all of these together ended up leading to kind of a hot spot in a really rural part of the county where we were finding lots of hornets that seemed like they must be there. And then we switched to trying to capture some live. We used radio tags designed for tiny birds and were able to finally successfully follow one to a nest, which unfortunately turned out to be in a hollow tree. We were anticipating it being in the ground, which is where they're more likely to be found. Anyway, this one was in a tree, so...
Harder to contain,
yeah, harder
right?
to contain. Yeah. Yep. And then we used the same approach. We vacuumed them up, collected them into a cylinder. Then we had all these living hornets, as it turned out, that we were able to flash freeze or even provide alive to some researchers in-state to see if we could develop better lures. So yeah, I was there for every step of the operation.
Vacuuming those suckers out there.
I was the vacuumer. I was the
really?
Guy right at the hole.
You were the guy holding the vacuum.
I was the guy holding the vacuum nozzle. The vacuum was actually sitting on the ground. But yeah. And then my boss was there with a 2x4 banging on the tree to try to get them to be mad and come out. So.
Oh, man. Yeah. How did you feel at that moment? Was it just like just doing my job? Or like did you have some adrenaline pumping there? How are you feeling in the moment?
I think the adrenaline pumping moment was stuffing foam in the tree crack to make sure they didn't come out somewhere we weren't expecting. That didn't last very long. After that, it was sort of exasperation because they, in my mind, based on YouTube, they were going to come swarming out. Instead, they trickled out one by one, kind of like, who's at the door? Somebody answer that, you know, like, and it just took forever. So, adrenaline quickly faded into boredom.
Okay. Cool. How much damage can they do to bee populations?
The unsatisfying honest answer is we don't know. For wild bees, there's not a lot of evidence that they will have a big impact. The main bee population that I think most of us are worried about are managed honeybees. Every human being on Earth now knows that bees, at least a subset of bee species, are responsible for a lot of the vegetable and fruit crops we like to eat.
I read that a small army of 15 to 30 hornets could easily wipe out a colony of 50,000 honeybees within a matter of hours.
During most of the year, the hornets are just catching insects and have pretty Catholic taste about it, right? They'll catch some bees, they'll catch some katydids, they'll catch some beetles. Late in the season, they switch to this mass predation on other social hymenoptera, including honeybees. And that sort of makes sense. This happens about when they're ramping up the production of the next generation. So they got all these really big fat larvae that they're trying to feed and have those larvae grow and develop into queens, which are, you know, almost twice as large as the smallest workers. So they seem to take a lot of resources. And if you think about a beehive or a paper wasp nest or something like that, it's a ready buffet of tasty animals that don't actually have hard bits yet. So they can avoid having to throw away useless legs and things like that. So what will happen is late in the season, a hornet will mark a nest, and that will recruit a group of her sisters. And indeed, as few as a dozen hornets can eliminate 50,000 bees in a couple of hours. And what they do in this stage is they catch them and they bite their heads off. But this time, instead of like then further processing the body and taking it back, they throw it on the ground and move on to the next bee. They just kind of go through what Japanese scientists call a slaughter phase. And they do this until the colony essentially collapses. It can't mount any kind of defense whatsoever. At that point, they occupy the hive, they walk around at liberty and pull those pupae and larvae out and fly those back to their nest. So it'd be sort of like if you went to the grocery store, got rid of all the clerks, and then just had the grocery store at your will.
Yeah, except the stuff on the shelves is actually little baby bees, I guess, right?
Exactly, right? You're just in that frozen baby bee aisle. So, and so that happens late in the season. It's definitely happened here already. Our worry is that, like many invasive species, the hornet will suddenly find itself in an environment where it is free of all population controls. No competitors. There aren't really any predators that we know of. And it'll go nuts. And also the way they keep bees in the U.S. and Canada, they're often enormous apiaries. And so if there were a whole bunch of hornet nests around and they found these apiary bonanzas, they could have a really, really huge impact. So
there is concern around these murder hornets disrupting the food web. Could this happen?
It seems unlikely that this species will dramatically impact most of those non-human food webs. They may increase costs for the human-maintained food webs. So that will just increase costs, but it probably won't amount to like vegetable Armageddon or anything like that.
I also had a look at this paper that was published in September of 2020.
There's actually now three independent studies that more or less find the same thing. Essentially, there's an expanse of really great habitat available in many, many places of the world. Again, mostly these temperate areas.
What are those regions that you found the Asian giant hornet could spread to?
So the place where it's potentially invading right now, the Pacific Northwest and most of the western coast of North America above the San Francisco Bay Area, looks like it's pretty great habitat. Like the entire eastern seaboard is basically good habitat, from like Newfoundland all the way to Kansas. I mean, it's a lot of habitat. And if you jump across the pond, most of Europe is a sitting duck. It looks like the Iberian Peninsula has a big chunk, like in the plateau there in the middle is a big chunk of harsh habitat, but everywhere else looks great all the way into continental Russia. So parts of Africa, Madagascar, the Atlantic coast of Brazil.
And is this likely to happen?
If we cannot contain it in our state right now, then yes, it is very likely to spread throughout the available habitat on the West Coast, unless we develop some new tools. Like I said, right now we're hanging mimosas in trees. Maybe we'll come up with much more attractive lures that will change the game on the ground. But as long as we're just hanging cocktails, they are going to move just fine through the Pacific coast. The weakest link in our entire program is figuring out how to find wasps at low densities early enough in the season to locate nests before they produce new queens and males. A huge part of the answer is having the engaged public.
Thanks so much for your time.
Cool. Oh, you bet.
You're listening to Living Planet, produced out of DW Studios in Bonn, Germany. There's more Bugging Out to come. Chris Looney in that last interview reminded us of just how important bees are. About 3/4 of all the fruits, nuts, and vegetables that we humans like to eat depend on pollination. But like many insects, wild bees, as well as honeybees, have been in decline. When you look at colony die-off in winter, that's an important metric for honeybee health, you'll find some grim figures, ranging from 25 to 42% annual losses over the past decade for beekeepers in the U.S. Now,
Beekeepers have gotten better at helping those colonies recover in spring, but the truth is, a lot of factors are working against bees. And one of those is climate change. Our next report comes from Botswana, where within the past 10 years, the southern African country has battled 8 years of drought. Decades ago, in the 1980s, Botswana's government identified beekeeping as a great strategy to combat poverty while conserving biodiversity. And domestic demand for honey continues to grow. Botswana imports more than half of the honey consumed there. But beekeeping has still not really taken off, despite its potential. With climate change ramping up, the success of beekeeping in Botswana may depend on whether beekeepers there are able to successfully manage climate impacts. From Botswana, Sharon Sipa has more.
The air is filled with the chirping of birds. It is perfumed with the freshness of spring from the flowers and trees dotting the land. Kaho Monghai and I are perched on camp chairs not far from his apiary, which is located on a small farm near Crocodile Pools in southern Botswana. The scanty-leaved tree in bloom towering above barely stops the noonday sun from scorching us. I'm speaking to the 29-year-old beekeeper who ventured into beekeeping after tasting honey for the first time during a high school trip, a taste that is growing among the people of Botswana. For Kaho Monghai, climate change challenges include bees living in search of cooler areas with better forage and water, the slowed building of bee populations because of delayed rains, and low honey production due to extreme heat. Not to mention the banded bee parrot, which is a type of parasitic wasp that thrives in scorching environments.
Since I started, I've lost over 50 colonies, and that's actually a lot when you look at the fact that I have 25 colonies currently. So I've lost more bees than I actually keep. Also, over the past 5 years, I've experienced a reduction in honey harvests, with 2017 being an awfully bad output in crop, and me only making around 6,000 pula in sales. But with 2018, 2019, the period was much better.
Financial losses from earning as little as $600, Monghai reveals, almost led him to quit 3 times. However, he realized that if he was going to continue doing business, he had to counter the climate change impacts. So he found space to rent in this Crocodile Pools farm and migrated some of his bees here, where forage is more plentiful. We are now dressed in white protective clothing. He is giving me a tour of the brown and white beehives dotting the apiary.
I moved 9 of my boxes from my home village of Ramata to this farm here in Crocodile Pools. They have better access to forage here, and I give them water using a chicken drinker, as surface water is scarce. This farm also has citrus trees and other plants, which the bees will benefit from in time.
You're listening to Living Planet on CILU 102.7 FM.
With bees in decline for decades around the world, the trend in Botswana could be even worse. Though bee research is in its infancy, sub-Saharan countries like Botswana are literal hotspots for bee decline. This is due to climate change factors like heat waves and drought. And as global temperatures continue rising, experts are warning beekeepers to be wary of a potential increase in pests and disease outbreaks that are likely to increase bee deaths and further diminish honey output. Melusi Rampart, a senior lecturer at the Botswana University of Agriculture and Natural Resources, explains.
Bees and plants have a very strong symbiotic relationship, hence climate change can indirectly influence honeybees through its effects on their resource base, including flowering plants, pathogens, and predators. Life cycles between bees and flowers may also change, potentially disrupting the mutually beneficial relationship.
Rampart views high temperatures, shifting seasons, bushfires and droughts as the most pressing threats to bees in Botswana. In order for bees in desert and semi-arid regions like Botswana to survive, Rampart suggests planting indigenous trees that are adapted to harsh climatic conditions. And he has further ideas.
Beekeepers should consider modified hives with controlled environments, they should also be thinking of the assisted breeding of bees that can survive the changing climate, as is done with crops, plants, and other animals. The assisted migration of bees from the Far East to the southern parts of the country in line with changing patterns can also be done.
At the Ministry of Agriculture, Principal Technical Officer Boatamesi Dimeku shares Rampart's view that climate change affects different areas differently. Despite his COVID-19 mask and the large desk sitting across his office that ensures our social distance, his voice fills the air.
If you take those who are keeping bees in Kagoroni, for example, where people plant trees, there are watering, there are a lot of flowers, there is a lot of forage for bees all the time. But when you go to rural areas, you would really see the effect of climate change. And when it's hot and the bees are not protected, the combs can actually melt and drop down.
To save beekeeping in Botswana, the Ministry of Agriculture is currently working on a strategy to encourage in-house beekeeping across the country, including in rural areas.
Be careful, Mama, okay? They kick these ones. Put that one on the ground.
The government hopes to turn beekeeping from a hobby to a commercial endeavor, thereby ensuring the sector contributes more to GDP as the country is setting itself up to become more food secure. The potential of Botswana's beekeeping sector lies in the fact that there is a ready local market for honey. This is because the country imports 38,000 metric tons annually, which is more than half of its total demand. Over the years, honey has become more popular as a sweetener and flu remedy in the country. Beekeeping is not labor-intensive and requires little capital and minimal technology, making it attractive for farmers. That is if they can manage the challenges, including climate change. For DW from Gaborone, Botswana, I am Sharon Tsipa.
Depending on where you grew up and with which traditions, eating insects may sound strange or delicious. Insects can be found in many kitchens around the world, and we're not talking about a stray cockroach in a cupboard. We're talking about cooking and eating them. In many parts of Africa, insects are an important source of protein in people's diets. Traditionally captured in the wild or in more modern times farmed, eating bugs is nutritious and cheap. But in South Africa, edible insects are facing increasing threats due to changes in their environment. And scientists are finding it's high time to harness traditional knowledge around those edible insects. Besides protecting species, this could also help towards more sustainable eating habits. From South Africa, Schutz has this story.
This sound, they make the grasshopper to come out like that, you see. When they hear the sound, like, you see, oh, you see. I catch it, after that, I put inside the hands, till the hands make full. After that, I can go to throw inside the plastic. Which means, I say, it's our meat, this grasshopper.
Ivan Mwima lives in Bolobedo South in Limpopo Province in South Africa. Using a leafy branch to tap the plants that grasshoppers hide in, he then catches them quickly as they jump. Here, the rolling green hills are not just full of modern avocado and pine farms, but also a hidden pantry of edible insects. You just need to know when, how, and what to catch and eat. That's exactly what zoologist Bronwyn Egan, who works with the University of Limpopo, is here to find out. She works with people in the area to catch different kinds of edible insects and then genetically and scientifically categorize them. Her aim is not only to protect traditional knowledge and the biodiversity surrounding the insects, but also pave the way to them being used more as a sustainable food source, as they require far fewer resources than other sources of protein, like beef. Today, Egan is meeting with Martin Wima, a relative of Ivan Wima, who is capturing grasshoppers. Martin Wima works with several people in the area to collect specimens. He also owns a business that is set to start selling termite protein bars.
Since I was born,
I've been eating insect almost every week because from the time that I know how to grab them, it's where I was collecting them myself and then fry them, eat.
People in this area, like Martin Weimer, know a lot about the insects, from where to find them and how to catch them, to the seasons each one appears in. Mopani worms, the large, squishy, edible caterpillar of a type of emperor moth, only appear around December till Good Friday, Martin says, but they are often dried and then eaten year-round.
So each kind have got their own way to cook. For the termites, and they are very easy to cook, and they are very nice, because some of them you can fry, like grasshoppers, you can just fry them and then eat. Termites you can cook and then fry, or maybe you can just dry them and eat them raw, like that.
With cars driving through the nearby village and people chatting in the background, we gather around a busy table. Weimer and Egan kindly offer me some mopani stew, cooked over a wood fire, along with some grasshoppers and termites.
Ever tried the dried termites?
No, this one.
Yeah, the crunchy grasshoppers are my favorite.
So if you're going to eat an insect, those are the ones.
Okay.
They taste really good.
Okay. Oh, it's crunchy.
Yeah.
I like it. That one's good.
Well, these are pretty good.
They are very good.
Martin Weimer is very enthusiastic about the insects and wants everyone to be able to enjoy them and learn about them. But he has also noticed that they have been disappearing in some areas, most likely due to building or farming, he believes, and are harder to find.
So we have to know that those insects are very important to our culture. We can live because of them. Next time, so we have to take care of them, we have to look after them so that next time we can be wealthy.
He doesn't just mean monetary wealth. The insects bring value as a healthy, cheap source of protein, and he wants to make sure that they're always around. And importantly, they also add to the biodiversity of the area. That's where Egan's work comes in. After she catches specimens with Martin Weimer and other field workers, she hops into her small white car and drives up the mountain pass to her home in Heinertsburg. In her office, she preserves the samples in alcohol to be genetically barcoded. This involves sequencing a short, unique identifier for each species. Traditional names and knowledge about use are then added to the entry.
Documenting life on our planet is really important. It's being lost so rapidly. We don't even have names for all the things that are being lost on a daily basis. And you cannot conserve something that doesn't have a name. If you don't know the natural distribution of an insect, for example, then that distribution range shrinks. You're not going to have known. You're not going to realize that it is shrinking for a start, so you won't be able to put in measures to stop that.
Scientific categorization is the first step of further work around these insects and their environment. A name and genetic barcode makes them accessible to researchers and conservationists, along with those who might want to commercialize edible insects. It's also the basis of understanding for how climate change, overutilization, farming, and other human activities affect these animals and the people eating them. The geneticist Egan works with, Barbara van Asch, is a senior lecturer at the Stellenbosch University Genetics Department on the other side of the country. She says that they already found 9 species traditionally used for food within a small part of the Limpopo region alone.
It's actually the most basic level of information that's missing here. It's not missing because the communities recognize the species and they understand that they are different from each other and they have specific roles. But in the mainstream scientific community, that gap is not bridged.
The information Egan and Van Asch collect will go into databases like the Barcode of Life data system, which is a global library of genetic information for various species that aims to protect biodiversity. It can be accessed by researchers, disease control specialists, conservationists, and others. Scientists like Van Asch, who describes the system as a workbench, hope to positively impact the communities that have offered up their traditional knowledge. Van Asch explains that she would love to find funding for households in areas like the Wemas to start a pilot project farming insects.
African species have been, in Africa in general, we've been underrepresented in science in many, many ways. And one of them is that the flagship species, the big five, attracts a lot of attention. But then the tiny five and the tiny 5 million and the tiny 5 billion of species that we have in this amazing variety of ecosystems have been poorly described. So the edible insects, in my view, are a dream project because it may help the communities, it may help solve a problem, and it also contributes to the description of biodiversity, hopefully before it disappears.
From Van Asch's lab with her sequencing machines to Egan's house with notebooks scribbled full of traditional names of insects, it all comes back to the insects in the rolling hills of places like Bolobedu South and the people who know and eat these insects. From Limpopo, South Africa, I'm Elna Schütz for DW.
And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our sound engineers, Robin Funke and Felix Heinzelmann, our studio director, Eliana Ghilarducci, and production assistant, Natalie Muller. And thanks, of course, to you, dear listener. You can find past episodes of Living Planet online or on your preferred podcast platform. Please subscribe to the show there as well. And rate us if you feel like it.
Sitting, thinking, sinking, drinking, wondering what I do when I'm through tonight.
Tune in next week for more environment stories from around the world. I'm Sonia Dean. Bye for now.
Girl will pass on by. Don't wanna be alone, but I love my girl at home. I remember what she said. She said,
as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must